You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and We Saw the Devil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Everyone, you are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and for today's episode, I have a few news headlines from the week, and then I'm going to be throwing out some true crime recommendations for you guys. I've watched a lot of true crime documentaries, I think we all have, and I'm going to throw out a few of my favorites for your consideration. It is Thanksgiving Eve. I know a lot of people are traveling to be with families. Some people aren't doing anything, much like myself. I'm not doing anything. But a lot of us want to continue watching true crime content, so I'm going to be throwing out some of my favorites. Before we get into everything, let's just get our housekeeping out of the way. Don't forget, you can always find us at WeSawTheDevil.com. From there, you can find us across all social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, as well as our Patreon. If you are liking the show, loving the show, and want to financially support the show, you can do so there, and also Patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. I know the episodes have been coming once per week. For the last 2 months, guys, it's been absolutely crazy. Started a new job, got a puppy, a dog had surgery. So trying to get back into the swing of things, and I'm using this Thanksgiving break to kind of get things going back in the saddle. So I'm super, super excited. I actually have never been so excited about the show. Lots and lots and lots of really cool things coming. I have a really huge interview actually in the works, guys, that I am just blown away by, and I'm excited. And it's actually tying into potentially a new series coming out on NBC. But I'm super excited, and there's so much cool stuff coming down the pike. But first, I want to know what you guys do for Thanksgiving. Do you have a tradition? Is there something that you normally do? I actually haven't had. I've always lived very far away from my family and never really flew in for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving actually has never been a super important holiday to me. I born and raised here in Nashville, but do not shoot the messenger, guys. I'm just not a fan of traditional Thanksgiving food. And it makes me happy to see that a lot of people actually feel the same way. I'm apparently not alone in this. For me, myself, what my tradition has always been is I will, obviously off from work, and I find the most authentic Middle Eastern restaurant that I can possibly find. When I lived in Maine, I found the most amazing Iraqi restaurant, and it was the best food I've ever had in my entire life. So for Thanksgiving, I would order a feast of Iraqi food and literally feast on that for 3 days. Like, that would be my leftovers. And I would watch movies, football, if my team was playing. And that kind of became my tradition that I've carried on with me wherever I've lived. I've always sought out that type of restaurant and just relaxed and taken a chill day. So I want to know what you guys do for Thanksgiving. So whatever social media account you follow us from, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, leave a comment and let us know what you do for Thanksgiving. I love hearing about other people's traditions and how they differ. In other news, guys, yes, there is a huge Lori Vallow dump. A lot of like really interesting stuff has come out, some videos, documents, largely relating to Melanie Pawlowski. And that's actually a character that we haven't really discussed in full on this podcast because there hasn't really been a significant amount of writing about her, evidence, involvement that we've been able to actually see proven, right? Via investigation or law enforcement. Well, that has changed. And Melanie Pawlowski, come on down. It is your time to shine. So a new episode with the Lori Vallow case will be coming to go over all of those dumps and basically keep you guys who are following this podcast for the Lori Vallow portion up to date, what's going on and what we think about it. So that will be coming up over the next week. But again, guys, today's episode is going to be just a few news headlines from this current week and some cool documentary suggestions for you guys that you can get your binge streaming on while you have hopefully some time to relax. So first, let's talk about this horrible tragedy that took place in Wisconsin. And no, I'm not talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. I'm talking about the Christmas parade attack. 39-year-old Daryl Brooks has been charged with 5 counts of intentional homicide, which I assume will be raised to 6 considering another young victim just died literally hours before I recorded this episode. Now, intentional homicide is the Wisconsin equivalent of first-degree murder. I know it can be confusing when different states call things by different names, but intentional homicide is the equivalent of first-degree murder, and his bail has been set at $5 million. What happened exactly? The motive is currently unclear. I think a lot of people, due to it being Wisconsin, pretty close to Kenosha, was it caused by the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict? Was it directly related to that? And it doesn't appear to be so. Directly before the parade attack, police actually received a call regarding a domestic disturbance that involved Daryl Brooks just minutes before he drove that red Ford Escape into the Christmas parade. He accelerated and he hit multiple marchers. If you're on Twitter, sadly, that video is being posted everywhere. Someone who was standing up like on top of a building, shooting video downwards onto the parade route, actually has video of the moment that it happened. And he plowed through multiple people. The police did not even have time to get dispatched or respond to the domestic call at the residence that involved Daryl, like minutes before the attack. So apparently, the chain of events was that there was a domestic disturbance, police were called, he got into his car, booked it right to the parade, and then just drove through people. As a result of Brooks's attack, 62 were injured, and as of this podcast, 6 have died, including most recently an 8-year-old boy. 3 of those victims were members of the Dancing Grannies, which is a dance troupe of women over the age of 50. Daryl Brooks appeared in court on Tuesday, yesterday, and it's unclear how he pled to those charges as of right now. And again, the motive is completely unclear at this point. What is known about him, though, is that he has a very lengthy criminal record. One charge also previously involved a domestic disturbance against his child's mother. And in case you haven't heard what he did to her, he also ran her over with the same red Ford Escape. So clearly he is a total winner. And I think, again, a lot of us were immediately wondering if this is retaliation for the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse case. There was a great deal of hostility. There were protesters outside the courthouse. But I personally, and this is just my own personal opinion, I don't think so. I don't think it's related. I think that it is a terrible tragedy committed by someone who has been a long-standing violent criminal and overall piece of human garbage. There are also even questions surrounding a stabbing that was nearby involving multiple people, potentially Daryl Brooks, and he turned down the parade route to get away from that stabbing and just kept going. So until law enforcement says otherwise, currently nothing is exactly known about motive or what exactly took place in the minutes leading up to this attack. Either way, it is incredibly sad, especially considering who's involved, who's impacted, over 62 injured, and we're going into the Christmas holidays. All right, so let's just take a moment here for a quick palate cleanser with a happier story. On November 2nd, Danielle Mobley and her 9-year-old daughter, Journey, were finishing up some grocery shopping at the Sabor Tropical Supermarket in West Palm Beach, Florida. They went shopping, they got their stuff, they checked out, and they were walking their groceries back to their car when suddenly a man approached them. He was wearing a gray hoodie and had his head covered, and he began to attack Danielle, the mom. He began to violently assault her, trying to get her purse, hitting her in the head and neck. And in a later interview, Danielle said that she decided to give up her purse, especially after the attacker told her to. He told her that he would, quote, pop her if she didn't. So she did. She let it go. And that's what we're taught, right, as women. That's actually one of my earlier memories as a teenager. Let go of your purse if someone tries to steal it because it isn't worth dying over. I think people are taught the same for their wallets or phone if they're mugged. My childhood neighbor, actually, the people who lived in the house next to me, her mother worked in downtown Nashville, and she was walking down the street to get some lunch, and she had her purse. She was walking on the sidewalk. Her purse was the closest to the street. Well, people drove by, and the guy grabbed her purse, thinking it would just be a really quick, you know, grab and take off with it. Her arm actually got caught in the purse as they accelerated, and they actually dragged her almost a mile down the road. And I remember when I was a child when that happened to her. She was our next door neighbor. It's absolutely terrifying. And she tried to let go of it. She even said that she tried to let go of her purse and people were like, well, why did you hold on to it? Well, she's like, no, I obviously know better and I didn't want to get dragged by a car. But that is one of the big things that we are taught. Let go of whatever you have. If you're being mugged or robbed, just let it go. It's not worth losing your life over. And Danielle Mobley tried. She let go of her purse. And just as she let it go, her 9-year-old daughter, Journey, comes out like a bat out of hell and started to kick and punch the attacker. Her mom was on the ground and this little girl comes up and just starts beating this man's ass. This little girl apparently kicked him so hard in the face that he just took off. And then this little girl, actually chased him for 5 blocks. This little girl pursued the attacker for 5 whole ass blocks. And side note, guys, bad idea to chase or pursue a robber, but the story does have a happy ending, so I'm just going to let that one slide. But seriously, can you imagine this grown man like attacking this woman? Her 9-year-old little girl daughter comes out. She UFC'd him. She came out like a UFC fighter. I just think that is so amazing. I felt my soul literally leave my body when I read that. In any case, Demetrius Jackson was the assailant's name. He got away, but he was actually arrested 2 days later and charged with robbery and battery. After everyone realized how Journey replied to her mom being attacked, she received a Medal of Honor and a certificate from the West Palm Beach Police Foundation. She went there and got to sit in cop cars, SWAT vehicles, and as well as on a motorcycle. And she said it was one of the coolest days of her life. And after being asked if she would do it all over again, she replied, quote, I would do it again. I fought back. I had to save my mom. And that is like the sweetest, cutest thing ever. And I can't imagine. Her mom in the interview was like, I'm very proud of my daughter, but I really just, yeah, probably shouldn't chase and pursue an attacker. And I think that is one of the most adorable stories that I've heard in recent memory. Just this little girl going at it, being like a UFC fighter, kicking him in the face, punching him in the, like boxing his ears. It was, you go, little girl, you go. Obviously that could have ended a lot differently, but it did not. So you go, girl. In other news that I have not seen reported anywhere, the man who was convicted of killing Amanda Knox's roommate, Meredith Kirchner, was granted an early release from his Italian prison yesterday, guys. Why is this not being reported like as it should be? This is a case that absolutely made the world stand still. I still remember getting into arguments with almost everyone I knew over whether we thought that Amanda Knox had involvement in Meredith's murder. And then the entire appeals process. And it's just been a whole mess of this entire situation. And previously on the podcast, we covered Amanda Knox coming out and discussing the Matt Damon movie that's very closely based on her case. And it's kind of like, guys, this isn't my case. I was involved and non-voluntarily pulled into this case, but this isn't my case. This is Meredith Kirchner. Rudy Guaita was convicted of murdering Kirchner, a British exchange student, back in October of 2008 and sentenced to 30 years in prison. That pretty much tied it up. His DNA was found. For those of you who may have been living under a rock during this time, Amanda Knox and her boyfriend, Rafael Solicito, were both convicted and then acquitted of Meredith's murder after spending 4 years in prison. And again, this case gripped the world. It was this young American girl studying abroad in Italy, had an Italian boyfriend, and her roommate comes up brutally, brutally murdered. Meredith was found sexually assaulted and had been stabbed 47 times in the home that she shared with Amanda Knox. And somehow, the Italian police immediately fingered Amanda Knox and Rafael Solicito for that murder. The tabloids went absolutely nuts. And what never ceases to amaze me is that people still think that Amanda was involved. I think on our own Facebook page for the podcast, people have argued tooth and nail that Amanda Knox is still guilty. She did it. In a YouTube section on Reddit, people are still convinced that Amanda Knox was this cold, calculated, awful seductress who somehow killed Meredith Kirchner in a sex game gone wrong, is I think one of the headlines that I saw on like some trash tabloid like Daily Mail or something like that. It's pretty incredible that people still think that. But Rudy Guaita's DNA, his semen, and his bloody fingerprints were found at the scene. Kind of open and shut case there, in my opinion, but What do you guys think? Do you think Amanda Knox had anything to do with it? Do you think it's horrible how Italian law enforcement and the media as a whole treated her? Or do you think that she was involved from the very beginning? Again, I don't understand how people at this juncture in 2021 still believe that she had any involvement whatsoever. But, you know, I think that there are a handful of cases that we can all discuss and put on the table where people act strangely, even if they are not directly involved, like Amanda did. So I don't know, guys. I know it's a big bone of contention in the true crime community. Throwing out what I think, what do you think? I want to know. Either way, my heart absolutely aches and seriously hurts for Meredith Kirchner's family, considering what happened to her. Rudy Guaita was actually convicted of murdering Meredith back in October of 2008, and he was originally actually sentenced to 30 years in prison. That time was then reduced down to 16 years after he had a successful appeal, and then he actually only ended up serving 13 years of that original sentence. With the remainder, he's being allowed to do community service, which I don't know. I think that if you murder someone, that you should probably serve time in prison, and as opposed to being allowed to finish it off with community service. But I'm not in charge of laws. But in any case, it seems like this case has kind of come to full circle to completion. He is now out and free. And let's move on to another absolute piece of shit, otherwise known as Brian Laundry. And you guys, I have to say something because this is literally giving me heart palpitations. I am seriously floored by the sheer amount of people who are calling Brian Laundry the victim of Gabby Petito, saying that she was mentally ill and she was the abusive one, and he just snapped in response to all of her mental illness. Like, somehow, because she suffered from some, again, unknown and unverified mental illness, that it's totally cool that he killed her. And I'm not sure exactly, and I find that it's almost all women that are saying this, at least like in the true crime community and circles, and watching a lot of comments that you guys are throwing out there, I find that a lot of women actually feel this way. Okay, let's just make something clear right now. Gabby Petito did not deserve to get murdered. And multiple people have come forward to detail how controlling and abusive Brian Laundry was to Gabby, way predating the road trip across the country. Was she also physically abusive to him? Yes. Was he physically abusive to her? Documented fact, even before the road trip. If you haven't, I highly suggest that you listen to the previous episode that we had with Brooke, who is an advocate and survivor of domestic violence. Domestic violence victims can and do sometimes participate in physical altercations with their abusers. That is also a fact. Sometimes behaviors are introduced to relationships, and that is put on as a mechanism in that relationship. It doesn't mean that Gabby Petito was any less of a victim of Brian. And in the end of all of it, Gabby Petito paid the ultimate price of being murdered. So this narrative of trying to paint Brian Laundry out as some victim of her is just so asinine and out there to me. I just do not understand it. If someone can maybe Crayola it down, explain like I'm five, like please do, because I cannot understand how anyone can frame this in that way. I sincerely cannot. We were all following this case 24/7, but can we like please not victim blame a 22-year-old dead girl? Last time I checked in my notes, she was the one who was strangled and dumped in a national park and left for animals, not him. What did he do? He just stole her credit cards and went back home to his family, where this news piece here, this headline begins. It has finally been released that Brian Laundry's cause of death was suicide via a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. So apparently, he did in fact go home back to Florida, and he did take his handgun. He did own a gun. He did take his handgun, go back out into the nature preserve and kill himself. And if you recall, partial remains were discovered in that Florida Nature Preserve on October 20th during a massive manhunt that spanned Florida up to Pennsylvania. I'm sure a lot of you guys were in it too. We were, you know, countdown. So many people supposedly saw him on or near the Appalachian Trail. I mean, it was just absolutely crazy. Dog the Bounty Hunter even showed up and started to try to, how can I put this nicely? He was trying to gain notability again by filming a TV show so he could pitch it to networks, and he was wrong too. So in any case, Florida's District 12 Medical Examiner's Office performed the autopsy on the remains that were discovered and positively identified them via dental records and DNA as Brian Laundry. So All you have to do is just take a step out onto Twitter and you can hear all of the conspiracy theories that Brian's parents killed him and dumped the remains. That it's just, I've never in my life actually, and this is even through the Lori Vallow case, like when the children were still missing, I have never seen a case with such outlandish, insane theories in my entire life. Have not. I do not understand it, but here we are. I think that Gabby Petito's family and all of this has been absolute class. And yeah, I'm not sure how Brian Laundrie not getting justice for the murder of their daughter will provide them closure. But I hope that this being finalized now, we know the outcome that provides them some sense of closure and ability to continue and move forward with healing. All right, guys. And in an actual huge, huge win for justice this week, the Groveland Four have finally officially been exonerated, albeit posthumously. And I actually cried real tears hearing this news. This is a case that I would like to cover in full for this podcast because it's a case that I have been personally interested in since high school. There are so many instances of misjustice in the American justice system. We see them all the time. Whether you're in our Discord channel and we discuss cases, or Facebook, or even if you're in other podcasts, you know, groups or discussion circles, you know that we consistently can think of off the top of our heads a handful of sentences and cases where someone was either incorrectly convicted, incorrectly charged. The Groveland Four is a great example of this. And this is just an aside. I feel like I'm kind of like complaining a lot in this episode, but you know what? I'm just giving my own thoughts and opinions with giving no fucks. It really actually bothers me when we on our Facebook post news articles about people of color, particularly African Americans. And it never fails 100% of the time that middle-aged white women descend upon every single post telling me to stop, quote, race baiting or, quote, sowing division. And it's like, wow, tell me that you need critical race theory without saying that you actually need critical race theory. It blows my mind. It blows my mind that I can sit here and post or cover stories of murdered white women from the 1940s, the 1950s, and they do not say a word. Oh, wow, that's incredibly sad. They will eat it up. They will digest it. The second that I post anything about a person of color, it's stop being divisive. Stop trying to break us apart. And it's a fascinating phenomenon to me. And here's an example for you. The best example I have of this is when I made an anniversary post this past March about the Negro Boys Industrial School in Wrightville, Arkansas. And yes, that was its name. It was a juvenile correction facility for Black youths between the ages of 13 and 17 who had committed just really small minor offenses. On the night of March 5th, 1959, one of the boys smelled smoke. That smoke turned into a raging fire that was quickly spreading across the building. Chaos ensued, and all of those kids were trying to escape being burned alive. But the doors were locked from the outside. They could not get through the doors. Could they break out the windows? Sure, but thick, heavy gauge wire mesh had been placed over all of the windows to keep them inside, so even breaking the windows did not allow for escape. At the end of that night, 48 boys had managed to escape, partially mangling themselves, while 21 burned to death. Police never investigated the cause, although it was clearly arson, and no one was arrested or charged. The mayor at the time was a segregationist, and he more or less said, well, it's the board of directors' fault, and recommended that there be no charges and no legal action. 14 of those dead Black children were wrapped in newspaper and thrown into an unmarked mass grave outside of Little Rock. And for 60 years, there has been no marker, no mention, and no memorial that indicated that the boys' school existed in the first place or that that fire occurred. It was literally erased from history entirely. Until April 25th, 2019, a monument to the dead was finally erected at the Wrightsville unit of the Arkansas Department of Correction, which now stands in the place of the industrial school. So according to some, me posting a memorial about this case, about this story, is divisive. And I would like to take a quick moment here to tell those of you who feel that way, first, to go fuck yourselves. And secondly, that I wish that I could just even say that I felt sorry for you, that I feel sorry for your ignorance or your blindness to American history and what has happened in this country. I wish that I could actually say that. But we all know, the rest of us all know, that that's not the root cause of why you are calling me divisive. But we all know why. So that being said, the next multi-episode series on this podcast is going to be about the Groveland Four. This case made news once again this week, finally for the right reasons. And I would like to give it the time and attention that it deserves, because it is yet another stain on the American justice system, a horrible tragedy, and it is a criminal case that deserves being highlighted. And I'm getting off my soapbox now. All right. Whew, I feel better. Let's get into Thanksgiving recommendations. Because again, I don't know how your family works on Thanksgiving. I have absolutely no plans other than what I traditionally do, which is order a heinously embarrassing amount of Middle Eastern food and watch movies, horror movies, or true crime documentaries. And guys, there is a lot to stream this weekend. If you are like me, the amount of true crime content is seriously overwhelming. It is getting away from me at this point. There's so much coming out on a daily basis, which I'm thankful for. There's so much good stuff. But how do you know what to watch when there aren't enough hours in the day? Let me help you out with a couple of my favorites here. I'm going to give you five of my favorites. The first is Trial by Media, which you can find on Netflix. And this is an incredible series that goes over various high-profile trials, the trial portion, and analyzes how, if at all, media coverage could have influenced the verdict. It's actually fascinating, and it's from a perspective that we haven't seen before in true crime content. Do you remember the murder that happened as a result of the two guys going on the Jenny Jones show, the one where gay man brought his best straight friend on to profess his undying love for him, let him know he was into him? A murder actually took place because of that. And it covers that one in detail, along with Rod Blagojevich. There was also a case in, I believe it was Connecticut, where a woman was raped on a pool table in a bar. And what happened because of that, she was kept anonymous. And then the media got in and divulged her identity. And it was a whole mess. And the series is fascinating, maddening, and it will 100% alter your perception on the role of media in our society, especially as it pertains to criminal cases and trials. Next up, we have Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez, also on Netflix. I will and cannot stop recommending this to everyone and anyone. I was living in Maine during Aaron Hernandez's time with the New England Patriots, and I even had a Hernandez t-shirt. Like, I'm a huge Pats fan. Well, he killed a friend by the name of Odin Lloyd. Why? Motive actually still remains unknown, but there is a distinct possibility that it could have actually been due to his own bisexuality. Back in 2015, Aaron was originally found guilty of murder in the first degree, a charge that, in Massachusetts, automatically carries a sentence of life without any possibility of parole. He was also found guilty of 5 separate firearms charges. This documentary starts from his literal birth and interviews his parents, his siblings, his cousins, his friends, his teammates at middle school, high school, collegiate, and NFL level, and really fleshes Aaron Hernandez out as a person. It's few and far between that we really get this intensely close portrayal of a person. It's fascinating and probably one of the absolute best true crime documentaries I have ever seen. So again, I think it's from like 2017, but if you have not seen this, you need to add this to your list ASAP. Number 3 is Long Shot, also on Netflix. Imagine for a moment that you were arrested for a murder that you absolutely did not commit. One day you wake up, go about your morning, you leave your house to go to work, and then suddenly a SWAT team has surrounded you and takes you into custody. The murder you're accused of was committed a while ago, but you have to come up with and prove your alibi. And this is actually what happened to Juan Catalan. He went to a Dodgers game the night a random murder was committed, and then he was arrested for that murder. And it just so happened that the TV show Curb Your Enthusiasm was shooting an episode at the stadium that night. So his defense team was tasked with reviewing footage, pulling him out of 56,000 attendees, in a race against time and a death penalty hungry prosecutor. That particular prosecutor in his case immediately eyed him for the death penalty, and she was known for getting people put to death. This documentary is simultaneously riveting and really, really, really terrifying. It's made in such a way that it makes it really, really easy for you to put yourself in Juan's position of, you know, the what if. And we've all racked our brains with this, right? If you're into true crime, is what would happen if, you know, someone planted a hair follicle in a scene or something like that? Or just what if there's enough circumstantial evidence that gets me fingered for a murder? And if you haven't seen it, again, it's called Long Shot. It's on Netflix currently, and you have to see it. My number four is Thought Crimes, The Case of the Cannibal Cop. You can find this one on Hulu. I was obsessed with this case when it comes out, and it follows Gilberto Valle, a former New York City or NYPD cop who was charged with conspiring to kidnap and eat women, including his own wife. If you recall, his wife came home one day and basically found his internet search history, and she read his communication in a forum called Dark FetishNet. And that forum is dedicated to like super grisly fetishes, like rape, torture, murder, cannibalism, things like that. Her husband, Gilberto, had been chatting with another user discussing how he would like to rape and murder his wife and then eat her, as well as kidnap and then cannibalize another woman. The communications were very long going, and he had actually discussed killing and cannibalizing more than 100 different women. They discussed different ways of cooking them, different ways of keeping them alive. And it was really, really like the world's darkest role playing, really. And this documentary actually covers that, because he was actually convicted. He was arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit kidnapping. And then he actually faced a maximum of life in prison for that conspiracy charge. Also, he would utilize the National Crime Information Center database to look up one particular woman who he was potentially stalking. However, throughout that entire trial, he said that the chat room and the forum chats that he had were just fantasy, that he had absolutely no intention of acting on them. They found him guilty of all charges in March of 2013. He was awaiting sentencing. That charge was actually overturned by a federal district court, and the judge said that the evidence supported his contention that he was only engaging in fantasy role-playing. At that point, Gilberto had actually already spent 21 months in prison, almost 2 full years in prison. That would have left only the accessing the database without authorization charge, and he basically they considered that time served, and he was released. Obviously, his wife left him and took the children. It's a really fascinating look at thought crime, right? Like the title is just makes it so absolutely clear. Your communication online. I know we have like the Armie Hammer case where he was engaged in cannibalism and stuff like that with women that he was dating, and said that he wanted to taste their blood and like cook them and eat them and all sorts of like really dark, gross stuff. At what point can communications like that be prosecuted? And this would have been a really, really, really important precedent. And I think this documentary does an incredible job of discussing the legal aspect of it and not just the fanfare, the taboo portion of it. It really actually does focus on law a lot, which is really kind of what I appreciated about it. It really does chronicle his arrest, trial, imprisonment, and what he's been doing since his release. And this one is from 2015. I think a lot of people either didn't hear about this case at all, or it just missed their radar, fell off their radar entirely. 100% worth a watch. You need to see it. And my number five pick, guys, is Capturing the Freedmans. And you can find this one on Hulu as well as HBO Max. And this is about as batshit as it gets. And this one was actually nominated for an Oscar in the documentary category. What this case is about, it's about David Freeman. He was the son and brother of two men, his brother and his father, who were convicted of child sexual abuse in a very, 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 very high profile case in the 1980s. They lived in just kind of like your everyday neighborhood. His dad taught piano as well as computer programming. It basically follows his life, what it was like growing up, and the shell shock of what happened when his father was originally charged with child molestation of many children. And then also it ended up coming out too that his brother was also accused of it as well. I don't want to spoil too much of it because this is actually kind of the magic of this documentary, is you going into the documentary blind and then going down the rabbit hole of the full story and the twist and turn. It's heartbreaking, but also it's just absolutely catastrophic for every single person involved. You have the upper middle class family. Their entire family was just ripped to shreds when all of this happened. And I think it's a look into family dynamics when someone is accused of and convicted of committing a heinous crime like child molestation on a larger scale, is we typically don't see the behind the scenes footage. And the interesting part about it is that most of the footage within this documentary was actually footage that David Freeman, the youngest son of those accused, captured himself. He was obsessed in the 80s. He got a camcorder and he was obsessed with film. So he actually documented his own family's breakdown as a result of these charges and finding these things out about his siblings and his family. It's heartbreaking. It's heart-wrenching. It's gut-wrenching. It's riveting. It is just an incredible documentary. And there's a definite reason why it was nominated for an Oscar. So that's my top five picks, guys. If you guys are looking for something to watch, there's a lot of stuff out there, new stuff coming out every day. These are what I would suggest as the do not miss true crime documentaries. But that is all for today, guys. I hope all of you have a very safe and wonderful Thanksgiving, either by yourself, with family, or with friends. Again, you're listening to We Saw the Devil. I'll be back in a couple days' time with an update on the Lori Vallow case in terms of the Melanie Pawlowski drama. And then also I will be coming with the Groveland 4. It's probably going to be a couple episodes to tell the full story and the detail that it deserves. So that will be coming. And then I have a massive interview currently in the works. So hopefully that will get nailed out. But a lot of really cool things coming, guys. And I know we're at the beginning of the holiday season here. So I hope all of you are having a wonderful time. Please, if you haven't, check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil, if you're interested in financially backing the show, or just following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, across social media. That's it for today, guys. Until next crime.